This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name's Sally Rippon and I'm a children's author and illustrator. I do a radio program that where I interview children's publishing people as well. And I'm really excited to have been invited to this event to be able to chair two very interesting people on the stage today that I'll give a little bit of an introduction to. But before I do, it's very important that I acknowledge that we're meeting here today on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present and to the elders of all the other communities. So on my left, we have Lee Hobbs, who I think everybody in this room will know already. He's our Children's Laureate for this year and next year. He's an artist that works across a wide range of mediums, and so you may be familiar with some of his sculptures. Most of you will be familiar with his books, and he's going to show us a little bit about some of his work a little bit later on. You will know Old Tom, Horrible Harriet, Fiona the Pig, Mr. Chicken. He's won many Children's Choice Awards, and Mr. Chicken Flies to Rome is his most recent one, published by Ellen Unwin. So can we give Mr. Lee Hobbs a hand? Next to Lee, we have Julia Eccleshare, who's come all the way here from the UK. She's a writer, broadcaster and lecturer, and the Guardian's children's book editor. In fact, when Mike Shuttleworth sent me through the list of all the things that she's involved in and she's done, I opted for the smaller biography here, but really somebody quite accomplished in her field. She's a judge of the Branford Boast First Novel Prize and a judge for the Whitbread Children's Book Prize. And she also won the Eleanor Fargen Award in 2000 in recognition of her outstanding contribution to children's books. So it's very special to have her here today to be able to give a balanced commentary between artist and critique. Could I put it that way?
Yeah.
Thank you. So thanks, Julia, for coming on. So I thought critique would be a good way to start off with, because it can be quite problematic, and you would know this yourself, Lee, as a writer and illustrator and artist involved in working with children's books, to get quite a bit of coverage in children's books. I don't know if it's the same in the UK, Julia, but here it's very rare to get some really serious in-depth criticism of children's books. First of all, I'd like to ask you, Julia, how do you criticise a children's book? Do you use the same techniques that you would use for adult literature, in your opinion, or is there a different way of addressing the way that you would look at a children's book?
No, I think the most important thing that we do at The Guardian is that we've always... we don't have enough children's book reviews. Nobody does anymore, I don't think. We have one a week, or we were having one a week until this month. We did have one a week, which... obviously isn't enough. That's still only probably 45 children's books in the whole year. And then we do some bigger roundups. But the whole point is that we give each book a serious space. It's not just one of those little postage stamp things. It's 800 words. And so you can consider, the reviewer can consider what the author's intentions were, how well they achieved it, and sort of where it sits in the canon of children's literature. And I think that's a very important thing to bear in mind. Normally what happens in children's book reviews, they're not reviews, they're a comment on it. And often they're more about how the audience will receive them than they are about the creation of the book. And I think that's a problem for all creators of children's books. Are you writing something... I mean, when people review adult novels... they talk about the writing of the book more than about the experience of the readers. But when they review children's books, and when they think about children's books, they think mostly about the experience of the reader. And it's how we respect the job that the author and illustrator has done as much in children's books as we do in adult.
And do you need a certain expertise to do that? Is it can anybody review children's books?
No, I don't think anybody can. Yeah. I feel very strongly not anybody can review children's books. I get very cross at the paper when, you know, I suddenly find that the cookery editor has a two-year-old, and so could they... I feel I'm not allowed to review cookery things, or, you know, the film editor has as a child and they want to sort of start getting a lot of books before Christmas, you know. There are lots of things that go on, which I think are very dodgy about it. I think it depends where you think children's literature should sit in the whole sort of cultural offer. And I suppose from my whole experience, I've been involved in children's books... well, I started by working on the Times Literary Supplement, which was a big review paper. So I've always seen children's books as part of the offer of books, rather than just as something that is part of the sort of entertainment of children or the education of children. That's the thing that really gets me, is when they're turned into educational tools. And I think that's a real problem for writers and illustrators of children's books.
Yeah, that'll be a great thing to explore in a little while. Because, Lee, I know that sometimes you've read a review where you feel like the reviewer has really got your book on a level. As an artist, you mentioned, for example, Morris Saxby, or really understood your work. And other people, how have good reviews helped inform you as a writer? And the bad reviews, not so much.
Well, the bad reviews make me want to give it away.
Sure.
But which is silly. But my problem with the bad reviews, it's like I find that with a picture book, that a kid will look at the front page, and you've got the front page to engage them. And, you know, if they're not interested or engaged, they won't go beyond it, or much beyond it. But in that front page, I spell out basically Lee Hobbs's world or logic, and you accept it or you don't. And if the kid accepts it, they'll go in and they'll whatever. But I find some reviews where it's almost like doggedly the adult review, I'm not going here.
Mm.
And not only will they not go there, they'll actively pick or deconstruct without, going in, you know, so they've not accepted the contract, you know. But
you mentioned one reviewer describing Mr. Chicken as
11. They might
that's
be
very
here.
Unfair.
Oh, yeah, that's Laurie and Kay, whoever that is, yeah. Well, Laurie and Kay said, Mr. Chicken, it doesn't look like a chicken. It looks like a lemon with fangs,
which
I don't know why he bothered to write the book. And now that it's sort of funny now in retrospect, but I never, ever have said that Mr. Chicken is a chicken.
Mm.
His name is Mr. Chicken, and that's what he looks like.
He could be a lemon.
Yeah.
But don't you find, because one of the things that I know a lot of illustrators find is that there are certain words that get applied to their work, and particularly illustrators like you who do line drawing that looks sort of fast. People call it quirky.
Oh,
or,
yeah, right.
You know, and there's a sort of very, very limited, like, it's as if there's a sort of limited number of words that people use to describe particularly picture books, I think.
Mm, well, some other person said, it's obvious that Lee Hobbs can't draw, This at least sends a positive message to children that anyone can do it.
Wow.
So that person might be out there.
But I'm really interested in that because in the UK, one of the things that's really nice about my job is that we have almost... we have a sort of unwritten rule that we don't do bad reviews because if you're only going to review 40 books out of 10,000 that are published, why are you wasting space on one
why
that you're going to put the boot
like.
In?
Yeah.
And the only reason we would do that is if it's a book, the only times I think that's acceptable is if there's a book that has had huge pre-publicity, you know, a very big advance has been paid for it, it's been splashed all over the place, it's piled high in Waterstones, then I think it's reasonable if a reviewer doesn't like it to be critical of it. But if it's just any other book, I say to them, don't do it if you don't like it. So I'm amazed that anybody should do that.
Well, your books are very high profile.
To Mr. Chicken.
Are you?
So can a review be subjective? Are there certain criteria where you can judge something as good or bad? Or is it very personal? Is it about taste? I love Lee's Mr. Chicken.
Yeah, I know, but my criticism, people don't have to like it. And my mother said I'd gone too far. I never knew when to stop when she saw Mr. Chicken. But the issue isn't whether people like it. That's taste, and that's fair enough, and that's subjective. But I think what we're talking about is the means by which someone approaches analysing, or without trying to sound pretentious.
Mm. Because you can say there is good and bad art.
Yeah. Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah, well, they're terrible children's books too.
Yeah. But I mean, the problem is that because children's literature tends to be taken. Not taken so seriously is that people think that they come to it very personally, and they think their personal response is what they're writing about, and they don't go back and think how well is this done technically. And you may not like it. I happen not to be a huge fan of fantasy fiction, but I think I can tell when there's a good fantasy novel and when there's a less good fantasy novel.
You can appreciate it for what it is.
Yeah. And with illustration, I mean, I think illustrators are far worst served of all creators because very few critics can draw, or know anything about it, really. So they go for very, very simple judgments.
Mm.
Are you able to respond to art in that way, or do you find that... Is that something you've taught yourself?
I'm always nervous on pitch works. I mean, I'm quite confident about some aspects to it, but because it's not something I really... Well, it's totally beyond me. Mm. But so I rely on knowledge rather than skill, mm-hmm. if you see what I mean. But, I mean, sometimes you can... I mean, there's things about how the story is told in the pictures. Mm. But if you've had experience... And this is why I don't like people who haven't had experience in children's books just sort of jumping into it, because I think they tend to be either overly impressed or overly critical because they're not sure what they're looking for.
And I think you'd find, too, Lee, that because children's books are short, people assume that... And for children, that they assume that it's something easy to do. One of the things that I like hearing you say the most is you work very hard to make it look easy. And I know how much work you put into it. And a lot of it isn't just what happens on the page, but it's everything that happens in the percolation of your mind.
Yeah, I'm people a bit embarrassed. Yeah, but I do work hard to cover up...
how hard you work.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
Yeah. But I've heard Quentin Blake say, I mean, I remember an interview a long time ago, and, you know, everyone looks at Quentin Blake illustrators and thinks he just goes, you know, any fool could do it, you know, because it just looks like some random lines.
But people say that at Picasso, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. But I remember him describing how you couldn't put the next thing down because it could be wrong. I mean, you know, it's not easy for him, just that it looks like it's easy for him. It isn't particularly easy for him because it's got to be right.
Mm. It's a bit like poetry, isn't it? You wouldn't say poetry is easy because there's less lines in it. Each word has to be the right word.
But most people think writing a picture book text is easy because it's so short.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. I studied Chinese painting for a while, and before I was even allowed to consider painting, I had to do straight lines on newspaper for months before I got my brushstroke strong
enough. Well, you know...
And it's the same idea, isn't it?
The music of Mozart, you know, I mean, it's divinely simple. Those lines in his piano concertos, divine, you know. And you, well, although he's a genius, so that's different. But, you know.
Well,
but, no.
But you've had a lot of people influence your work over the time, and not only picture book people. You have a really broad range of interests.
Well, I'm an enthusiast. I think I I'm very grateful to reach this advanced age, and my interests and passions are as burning... My pilot light is burning bright like it did when I was six about art and architecture and classical music and history. And I think they're the things that feed my... they feed what I do in kids' books. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea that a kid might pick up a spark in one of my books about a drawing of... the Pantheon or something, and think, gee, that looks interesting. Because that's how I responded to the people whose work I loved when I was a kid.
Yeah. And did you grow up reading a lot of children's books? What brought you into... How did you become so interested in children's books?
I did grow up reading a lot of children's books, so I was a very poor reader and didn't learn to read until I was very old. But I was read aloud to a lot, so story was very much in my life. And... I certainly remember the books I read before I was, you know, 11, very clearly. And then I was very lucky when I was at university, I met a children's book editor, and my best friend's mum was a children's book editor, and she told me all these stories. So when I went to work on a review newspaper where I was meant to be doing history books, because that's what my degree was, I got given the job of commissioning all the children's book reviews because I was interested in it. And in those days, the Times, it seems unbelievable, but the Times Literature Supplement did 4 24-page supplements a year of reviews of children's books. Wow. It was taken really seriously in the UK at that point.
So what's happened? Why is it taken less seriously now, do you think?
Well, I think what happened was that, I mean, there was, you know, the publishers didn't advertise the books, and so there wasn't any money in it, basically, is what happened in newspapers are driven by that. But it coincided actually with a time in the UK when children's books were not in a particularly good shape between the sort of 1980s and 1990s. Now, the children's book market is the bit that's really booming. I mean, you know, the trade is booming. Library borrowing is terrible in the UK, except in children's books where it's very strong. And it drives the adult authors mad. But at literary festivals, it's the children's authors who get all the attention. Mm. They're the ones who have the big signing queues. Mm. So, you know, we're always hopeful that there will be more coverage. We've had sort of very good times. We had a whole radio programme. We had Treasure Islands, which was a 15-minute radio programme once a week devoted just to children's books.
Right.
But these things sort of come and go.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a consistency about it because people don't see... I think people don't understand how important it is to... help people into the world of children's literature. They think any fool can understand it, but actually it's quite difficult.
Mm. And how important is media coverage and reviews of children's books, Lee? You've got quite a high profile now. Perhaps it was a little bit more important when you were first starting out. Do you want to comment on that? Do you think it is important to
Well, people have to know the books exist. Mm. Of course, that's one of the reasons why school librarians are so important, because I think that's where kids learn about the books and learn how to appreciate them and learn find their own taste. I mean, kids have different... Yeah, so it's very important. But I don't know how many people read newspapers now.
No, I mean, I think reviews are only one way to the market. Yeah. I think librarians are incredibly important and, you know, sometimes good teachers who have had a chance to read enough. But what's really interesting to me at the moment is how I think children's reading has changed dramatically all since Harry Potter. And this isn't, you know, I don't want to have an argument about the quality of Harry Potter, but I think we should never underestimate the importance of Harry Potter in the change in how the outside world see children's books, but also in how children read. Because if you think of all the images of children as readers pre the 21st century, words like bookworm, solitary, shut away, reading under the bedclothes, all the talk about children and reading was a very private, very intense experience that happened alone. And now, if you talk to children about reading, they all want to read the book that everybody else is reading, and they want to be reading it at the same time. And I noticed with the Harry Potter, you know, with Harry Potter, that... you could stand at a bus stop and you could hear parents and children talking about a book. That's was absolutely unheard of. The only other time I ever saw everybody wanting to read a book was when Matilda was published and one of our sons was in primary school and suddenly everybody wanted to read it. Right. But that wasn't true of all of Dahl. And it, you know, it didn't last. But with Harry Potter, everybody wanted to have that book. And now in the UK, everybody wants to read David Walliams. And everybody wants, they want to know the same things. I'm not saying that's necessarily good, because I think there are disadvantages to that, but I think it is a very interesting change about reading, and it's a way that reading has become a social thing. And if you think of adults all belonging to book clubs, it's a very much the same sort of thing. Mm. And that could have quite an interesting change in the development of how books get out there, but it could have a reduction, it could be a sort of reductionist view, because you'll just have... You know, everyone will read five titles. Everyone will have read The Hunger Games, Harry Potter, you know, whatever.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because it does seem to have opened up a really big space for conversations even between parents and children about books, because a lot of adults have read Harry Potter as well. But then I guess the challenge is what next? You know, that once you've read that there are a lot of other books there that perhaps go unseen. And are they the ones that you would advocate would most need media coverage and perhaps receive it the least?
Well, I think, I mean, you know, I have this dilemma every week. Is my job to provide a review of a book that is being much talked about elsewhere, i.e. for my paper readers, should I do that? Or should I find the quirky, interesting, unknown book, which is what I like to do?
Right, great.
So, there is that. I mean, the other way, we were discussing this at the IBI Congress in New Zealand about another way of that sometimes the quieter books. I mean, it's very difficult to get attention for quiet books, and yet quiet books, if I asked everybody in this room the book that made them a reader, they'd all know, probably would all know, and often it's a quiet book that isn't a world-famous title, if you know what I mean. But sometimes prizes are very good at recognising those, and then that can carry them. And, you know, you have to get... I mean, as Lee says, if nobody mentions them, who's going to find them? Mm. I get 10,000 children's books a year at home. And I just don't know how anybody will find most of those ones.
See, when I taught at Uni High, there was a terrific librarian. Well, they were all terrific librarians. A great library. But there were, you know, there was a kid that was... All he wanted to do was to... He was in year seven. All he wanted to do was to write a cantata. And it was his ambition. I don't know whether he's done it. But what was great was that Newton, the librarian, introduced him to another kid who wanted to write a concerto. So they ended up great pals and would sit and discuss music construction. Wow. These are kids that were 12 or 13. But the point is that they didn't fit into the usual model of the reader, and yet they were absolutely feeding him about reading. He was one bloke, the cantata fellow, was down there reading Bach's life story. The other fellow was into Mozart and Haydn. And they would discuss music,
yeah.
you know, but through books.
Had they not had that place to go, the library, that
and
place
that
of sanctuary,
that,
yeah. and
you know,
the fantastic
yeah.
library.
The match made in heaven.
Yeah. Mm. Because I know as a laureate, I think each laureate has a passion of their own that is really important to them. And for you, it's definitely libraries is a really important
well,
thing.
Well, yeah, and drawing, you know, not just reading, but the whole creative thing that kids oughtn't feel that they... that's bad English, but they shouldn't feel... I can't spell either.
Nor can I.
Kids, just because a kid isn't... I never say to kids, you're all artists and you're all writers, because they're not. Mm. I would never be good at sport, but I say just because you're not good at writing or drawing doesn't mean to say that you can't write a poem or do a drawing. You know, the fact that it... Hopefully it's not for public consumption. But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But this is the thing about people having different drives and different tastes.
And there's really. Room for something that doesn't have to be marked or graded as
oh,
well. Just playfulness
and personal
expression.
Everything's overly
expression.
Marked and assessed now.
Yeah. Mm. So you've often said when parents come up and say, how can I get my kids to draw? You say, give them a notebook.
Give them
a
sketchbook.
Yeah.
And don't look in it. It's private kid business.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, our
Bossy
children,
boots.
Our children's laureate in the UK currently is Chris Riddell, who is also a very...
fantastic illustrator.
A very, very gifted illustrator. And he created, one of his laureate projects has been to create this book called A Doodle A Day, which is just a sort of shape on a page, and everybody can have their own copy, and just it's an it's an incentive to every child just to do a little drawing.
Yeah.
It's a private, you know, it'd be the child's private space, but there's a sort of spur to do something every day.
And he's spot on. I read, someone sent me the link, and it's the same thing. He says that it should be a private space. It's the one thing that doesn't have to be assessed.
Mm.
You know, and the pressure for kids now in schools is incredible. You know, I went to one school recently, and something to do with NAPLAN or something, the kids that aren't that bright, they get them to stay away on a certain day.
Wow.
Oh,
God, Lee, I've been told I need to keep you
better
close
pass
to your
over
mic.
That.
So, how are they accessing these drawings? Is this an online thing that Chris is doing? Or
no, you just buy the book.
Mm. Yeah,
you spend $5.99 and you get the book, and it's got the 365 little illustrations he's given you, and
fantastic.
You just fill in.
Yeah.
You know, you make it your own.
Correct.
But it's he believes very strongly that you know, children should be given the opportunity to draw when they can, away from any kind of observation or assessment. But just because, I mean, he always says that he started drawing, his father was a vicar, and he used to have to go and sit through the sermons, and he would just sit there drawing, and nobody paid him any attention.
Yeah.
And it was a very liberating way of getting confidence.
That's great. Well, Sean Tan was saying on radio a couple of weeks ago when I had him on the program that for him it was being bored. It was those long summers. He wasn't a sporty kid, and it was too hot to play outside.
Yeah.
So he'd go up to his room. There was nothing else to do, so he had to draw. And so he's a very strong advocate of letting children become bored, that's when your imagination gets the chance to kick in.
Yeah.
And it is a little bit problematic, I think, when we do try to fill children's time, every moment of their time, so they don't have that creative space to be able to just to go into that imaginary world.
Mm.
So were you a big drawer when you were young?
Always.
Yeah.
I was. Dad gave me a clock, and it was set for 6 o'clock. And I've got a photo of it actually.
Can we show you the first
if you like.
Picture of the slide?
But the alarm would go at 6. There I am. See that clock? Oh God, it's 8:20. What was late for school? But see, that shows my because I didn't read kids' books much as a kid. I looked at the pictures, Ludwig Bemelmans and Ronald Searle. I adored.
So Ludwig Bemelmans.
He's Madeline. But I've never ever read a Madeline book. But I've always looked at the pictures.
Mm.
But I'm reading the Reader's Digest omnibus there. But underneath the bed was a pile, Julia, of Look and Learn magazines from England. So anyway, so that's
so a lot of people were all making noises like they knew what they were.
Yeah, well, I loved all that stuff.
So you would read a lot of non-fiction.
Well, because my imagination was such that all those things fed in, and I could construct. You know, I could draw an accurate 18th-century pirate outfit. You know, at that age, because I just looked at so many books and the pictures.
Yeah, great.
No great kind of fame there, but
I'm going to go on to the next slide. We've got a few slides here.
Oh yeah, this is Ronald Searle. Hands up who knows of him. Well, one of the greatest graphic draftsmen of the 20th century. And when I was a kid, the school libraries were chock-a-block with Ronald Searle right. books. So yeah. I pored over them and put them away. I was saying to Julie at one age, I put them away for about 15 years. And because I thought, oh, no, I'm being influenced too much. And so I got them out, and as I looked through them, I got that same rush of delight. And I actually wrote to him, and we had a lovely correspondence. And this is one of his letters. I wrote a piece for The Age, and he sent me his book. And that it even had his fingerprints in the back in the cardboard. I've kept that quite sadly. But
sent him the piece from The Age?
The Age sent it. Jason sent it to him. And
so this was quite recently?
He's been dead a few years, so not that recent. but anyway, it was
not
lovely
to
make contact.
Yeah.
And it's something, I mean, Julia worked with his wife. So.
Right. Yeah, you were saying that. And that was as an editor?
I worked at Puffin, and Kay Webb, who was Ronald Searle's wife, was she made the modern Puffin list, and Puffin was so influential on children's reading for about 30 years.
Amazing.
Really.
Yeah.
And I was saying to Lee, I mean, it wasn't just that she was a brilliant publisher and editor. She was just kind of, long before people had realised that, you could engage children with, as it were, like we now have loads of literary festivals. She was running these holidays. She sent groups of children away with children's authors on holiday.
Wow.
I mean, how suspect
would you be
is that? I mean, it's sort of unbelievable nowadays.
Yeah.
But she knew the power of the children meeting the author long before other people had sort of got the point
of
it.
That's
and
huge.
She put on huge exhibitions. I mean, amazing stuff she did around Roald Dahl. And she started the Puffin Club, which was, again, an example of this idea that children wanted to join together and also, be able to read additional material by the authors that they loved. Anybody who recognises how strongly children identify with an author, I mean, the author is the brand, is kind of where we are in the UK at the moment. And that idea that, kids who are keen about an author will read their shopping list. I mean, they don't really mind. They just want to be part of that world. And it's a bit like you with Ronald Searle, you get influenced by somebody. And I think for a lot of children, that becomes a big part of their reading experience.
And do you think you have to have a connection or a relationship with children to be able to write well for them? Apparently, I don't know if this is a rumour or not, that Roald Dahl couldn't stand the little blighters.
Dahl could stand children.
Or anybody, probably.
No, anybody much. I think you have to have... I think there are lots of ways that people write for children, but I think for me, the ones I like best are the ones who seem to have an ability to never go outside of the child's view of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's as if they can still remember their childhood, the feelings of childhood. It's not I can remember the doings of childhood, but I don't think like a child. But I think there are some people who can still be inside that child's world. And I think there are other ways of writing for children. Some people do it by sort of observation. But I particularly like the kind where you remain in the child's world all the
time. That's
where
the authenticity comes from, isn't it? I think children respond to that too, don't they? And what about you? Do you have a strong memory of yourself as a child, or do you feel like you can tap into that childish part of yourself? Because there's something very playful and very subversive about all of your books.
Well, but my memories of childhood are imbued with, I'm 63, so I've got a lot of things have happened. So it's hard to sort of separate what's the child. But I think I can.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, with kids, I keep my distance with kids in a way. Even, when they come up, I'm nice. But I'm a very...
You do your best, yeah.
My relationship with kids, it was as a teacher, was very much on the adult voice. I muck around and tell them to get cracking and all that.
Lee, you do understand, because that thing you said at the very beginning about how children either buy into the concept or not, that is an understanding of how a child thinks.
Well, this is what I think is fabulous about kids, and this is why we've got this picture. This is old Tom, and this is this is the first page of the first old Tom picture book, and it's set up because Angela is, it's the relationship between a mother and a son. So... Yeah. Angela is coming in, looking to us as if she's coming in on the stage. Old Tom is the sort of the, 7-year-old son. And so a kid looks at that, they'll either get it or they won't. But that basically is Lee Hobbs's world, or my logic for the book. And if someone doesn't get it, well, they won't continue. That's fair enough. But what I love about kids is their willingness to trust what you've laid out for them there. A kid has never, ever in 20 years said, how come old Tom sits on a couch or... You know what I mean? Anyway, but that's there because the real... why kids really like old Tom, if they like him, is because that's their relationship there.
Yeah, so they're sensing the heart. Yeah. And do you think there's something, and Julia, you might like to comment on this, do you think there's something about the anthropomorphism, I always find that tricky to say, making characters into animals that make it easier for children to relate to? It's not too close, that they can see themselves in it, but it's not exactly themselves. So I know, for example, Margaret Wilde, if she's dealing with a difficult topic, might use animals instead, like Old Pig, to talk about death. Do you think that that's something that's used quite commonly in picture books, that children's... books will have animal characters in because it's too close if they're reading about another child.
You're going to answer that?
I've never, ever thought of it. All I thought was...
Why did you choose a cat?
Well, I didn't. I mean, I just did the shape and I liked the character. It's only afterwards that I realised that I've drawn another animal. Mm. I mean, I do actively shy away from the cutesy pie. I've never chosen, that came about because a mutual friend of ours in London said, was it Claridge's? And after a couple of champagnes and a cocktail.
You told me it was just tea a minute ago.
No. Well, that was after the afternoon tea. Andrea said, you love London. Why don't you create a character that lives here? And I said, all right, it's a badger. It works at a hotel like this. And he's the special events manager. I don't know how much it was the cocktail speaking, but it came only later. Someone said, "Oh, you're always doing animals," and it hadn't occurred to me. Anyway,
because Julie, you've spent a bit of time on Beatrix Potter. You've written some books on her.
Well, there are traditions about this, and the arguments about who children identify with, I think, can be a bit spurious.
Right.
I think there is a neutrality about an animal. They're not gender specific. They're not race specific. That can be an advantage, or they can just have lovely characteristics. I mean, you can be very playful around animal characteristics, but I think we can sometimes read too much into it. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I think the kids engage or they don't.
Yep.
He's the only. I keep pointing there. Sorry, I'm not pointing to anything. He's the only animal in the book. Everyone else is human.
But is that the case in Old Tom as well? He's the only animal... It's just him and Angela, isn't it?
Yeah. But there is that kind of great leap in this, that the reader, the child reader, has to think it's perfectly acceptable for a badger to be part of the...
And living in a teapot house.
Yeah, right.
So once you've brought them into your world and they've accepted that these are the rules of the world, they're going to go with you.
They'll go with it. Listen, a kid can construct a wonderful world or story about having breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the thing that a lot of adults forget, that the imagination of a child is not limited in the same way that an adult... And only an adult would pick, say, me up or some other people about certain things in a book, wouldn't occur to a child. Mm. It was a child that's... an adult asked me once, how come, old Tom is a different size in each picture? And I thought, oh, God, I don't know. Anyway, I went quiet trying to think of an answer, and some little arm threw up their... Oh, no, the person threw up their arm. And I said, what do you think? And anyway, I had no idea. And the kid said, I've worked it out. When old Tom is being ticked off, he's small. When he's bold and naughty, he's big.
That's right.
And anyway, I thought, absolutely right. I have never forgotten that, so I trot it out every time someone gets serious.
That's great. Mm. So you've got a few more slides here.
Oh, yeah, only a few. Mm. This is where he works, which is an amalgam of all those early 1900s mad London hotels.
Mm.
But once again, that's a ridiculous building, but a child just, would never...
So this is an invented one?
That's where
he works.
But
it's got reference to historic buildings.
Mm. Yeah, in Piccadilly.
Which the great thing for children who are lucky enough to have been brought up on picture books is that they absorb all this kind of reference without even knowing they're doing it. And that's how they, that's how they then begin to see the world.
Mm. So do you see...
Do you see the role of the picture book in that it's the illustrations that connect with the child, almost like a film, like watching a film where the visuals are being experienced in one way and the sound is being experienced in another way. Because a picture book is usually meant to be read aloud, isn't it? And it's the connection to the child through the illustrations, do you think?
Yeah, but I think a lot of children just read the pictures and they don't care very much about the words.
I think that the kids really... The important thing is that they're engaged and they enjoy it. Mm. It's for adults to leaden it by some kind of...
You don't have to ask too much of it.
No. So I don't know what's here now.
I love this one because it really does show your fascination with architecture. And you've always had a fascination with...
Oh, that one. No, the next one.
All right, let's show this one.
All right. This is my love of London. That, no, it is. Oh, it's meant to be a serious... No, it's not. That on the right is, see, I've been to London 31 times, but that building on the right is part of a beautiful Nash building that was kept in the 70s when everything else was demolished. And in the background is St Martin in the Fields, where I always go. It's my reference point in London. So there's nothing really more to say about that. It was just...
There's
Mr. Chicken in a realistic
Someone very strange in the top of that bus.
Yeah, I know. Well, he's having a good time. He's sitting where I usually sit.
Isn't the absurd something that, you know, we know, I think anybody who's ever worked with children and books, that children love the absurd. Mm.
Well, this is what I think is wonderful about kids, that they will accept a ridiculous picture like that.
Yeah.
It's kids' logic.
Yeah. Mm.
I think kids' logic is something to be cherished and celebrated, because it's something that adults lose. Mm. It's that willingness, if they're engaged, to follow you anywhere.
Mm.
And I think it's a wonderful thing.
And it also reflects their own self-belief of their place in the world. You know, so they identify with Mr. Chicken and they'd like to be that big person, not the small little thing.
Glad I'm not.
Well, watching children play, you know, they can play with a little truck and try to climb into it.
Yeah.
And for them, there's not really a distinction between whether it's a real truck or an imaginary truck. And often you'll notice that in children's literature too, that as the books become older, there's a designated portal where they pass from the real world to the imaginary world. Yeah. Whereas this age, anything...
But I think too that's a problem with kids, that they perceive, because there's a point where kids move and they suddenly think, uh-oh, this is childish.
Yeah.
Mm.
And childlike, and they're, I don't know whether they're pushed or, I mean, I felt it, you know, you suddenly have got to be grown up.
Mm.
And recently I visited a school and they were year nine kids and I thought, oh, no, you know, because they're like Kelpies. Well, they are, you know, wild, but, you know, scratch the surface, really, they're still kids. Mm. I don't know.
And drawing connects children of all ages too. Mm. I mean, it would be really tricky to come in front of a group of year nines without being able to talk to them about the illustrations. We were just analysing the text.
They were drawing old Tom, so once they started, though,
they were fine.
Yeah, that's right, Julie.
They would have loved it. All right, I think we've got a couple more here.
Yeah, there's just two more. This is just my love of architecture. This is why I'm glad this is the new Mr. Chicken Arriva Aroma. And this is because the little boy at the start of the slideshow, that's what he was looking at. That's what I was, and I was intrigued by architecture and atmosphere. There's not much atmosphere in that picture, but it was the atmosphere in Ronald Searle books and Ludwig Bemelin's that made me want to draw. So whereas a little kid, if the kids are engaged in modestly what I do, it's something to do with the very things that drove me to be a creator.
Mm. When I look at that picture, it looks almost like creating would be almost an act of meditation. I can imagine as a small child you'd spend a lot of time on that page. You would be looking at every one of those little characters.
That's
quite a connection to
I got sick of drawing the back of people there.
All right, I think there's one more from...
One more, it's Mr. Chicken at Trevi Fountain. So that's the serious one. Yeah, so... But, you know, that's, once again, just how lovely it is as an adult to be able to feed into what you're doing for children. And maybe, you know, every now and then a little kid will pick up something from that picture and think, oh, you know, I like buildings or, you know, to stretch them.
And interestingly, a lot of your characters for children, because some people think that when you write a children's book, all the characters have to be children, but most of your characters, other than perhaps Horrible Harriet and the 4F for Freaks, they're adults, really, very childish adults or quite displaced adults.
Yeah, and yeah, they're not well... Look, most of my characters are based on kids I used to teach at Preston Tech. Oh, gee. Yeah, well, I don't know. I hadn't thought of it like that.
Do you think that there are there fashions or so forth in children's books, do you think, Julia, that you've seen in your career that come and go? Are there ones where a lot of the characters will be teddy bears, or there'll be...
There are huge fashions in picture books. Teddy bears can be very dominant for a very, very long time, right. And then they sort of, you know... You only have to have a book that wins a prize with a teddy bear as the main character, and then you get an awful lot of teddy bears coming along or whatever. There are fashions. There are fashions for all sorts of things. There are fashions about whether they should have a lot of words or very few words, and we seem to go from sort of extremes about that. But, I mean, that's because it's a creative field, and there is no... The wonderful thing, well, there are lots of reasons why I've loved working in children's books. I mean, I got into it by chance, but one of the things that's so wonderful about it is that everything is possible. Mm. There are no rules about it. Mm. You know, there isn't a... You can't say what the next big book is going to be. You can't say what's going to be a great story. It can sound like nothing, but somebody can make it into something absolutely wonderful.
And are you finding every year that you're finding a gem that just makes you excited about what it is that you
do? Well, it's very... I mean, you know, I read a lot of terribly bad books, but I also read a lot of, you know, really wonderful books, and I read a lot of books which are nearly really wonderful books. Right. And I just think...
What are they missing that makes them not quite step up to the mark, do you think?
Well, there's lots of different things.
Where do you start?
In fiction, I think the problem is... I suppose for me, it depends what you like. I like books, whether they're picture books or fiction, that are what I would call underwritten. I like the author or illustrator to leave a space for the reader to tell some of the story. I don't want to be told everything. Yeah. I don't want to see everything. I want to have to work some of it out myself. And I think it's very hard, particularly for first authors, to trust the reader. Mm-hmm. And so I think what often happens is that there's at least one and often three storylines too many. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not only that the granny was killed by a bus, it's also that the baby died of diphtheria, and it's also that somebody else got killed by a train. You know, whatever, there's too much going on. And I think... Because I think one of the dangers of working in a field that people think is not properly supported is that you try and push it harder and harder, and actually we get better books if authors are sort of pull back and trust that readers... I mean, really just what Lee said about, you know, the kids either look at it and buy in. Mm. You don't have to hold their hand all the way.
Mm. Yeah. I absolutely agree with that, because I think... there are a lot of gaps in whatever I do, because I really what I do, they're character studies, but kids will fill in any gaps, like you know, like that kid did about this changing size. And I mean, Mr. Chicken in that bus is twice as 10 times bigger than he is on the plane, but I simply can't be bothered explaining why that is. No, I leave it to the kids, you know, because if they go past that first page, they're going to realise that the whole thing's going to be a bit strange, and they'll think of a reason for it, I hope. Mm-hmm. Their parents may not.
Sure. Yeah. Is there anything you can't put in a children's book, Julia? Have you come across anything where you thought, I don't know if I'd be comfortable with a child reading that, or do you think that every author who writes for children already knows that that anything can be covered but done in a certain way?
Well, I think you can have bad taste, but I suppose one of the reasons I've, again, feel very, very privileged to have worked in children's books is that, on the whole, I think that children's writers have a very benign view of children, which sounds like, you know, a silly thing to say, but the whole world doesn't like children, and I think it's important. I feel very lucky to have worked in a world where people do like and respect them. But one of the things that moves me most about reading a lot of the books I do is the responsibility of children's authors. I mean, the sense of moral responsibility, which sounds terribly pretentious, but in a world where, you know, there are a lot of quite ugly political views, I find it very, a privilege to work in a world where the political views of most children's writers are very honest, very positive, very progressive, and very inclusive.
And even if they're challenging, they seem to be done with a kind of sensitivity that we're perhaps missing in other media in film or in advertising.
Yeah, but that's because I think they care. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's because children's authors sort of... I don't think they're restraining themselves. I think children's authors genuinely care about making the world a better place. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're trying... That's one of the things they're trying to convey in the work that they do. And in the UK, there have been periods when we've been through... You know, we are going through one at the moment of terrible hostility to particularly... immigration, and you know, the counterbalance to that can come in children's fiction or children's picture books. And you think of the kids who are otherwise going to have, how else will a child know, how else will a child be able to challenge what their parents think or what they're seeing on the big billboards outside shops saying, you know, go home scum or whatever? How can they challenge that? By reading a story which shows them something completely different.
And they're malleable at that age. There is hope as a children's author that you can affect the next generation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, I want to leave plenty of time for questions because I'm sure there are some good ones. Do we need a little bit of light on for questions? Perhaps not, maybe not. So I'm going to leave it up to people roving around the mics. Pop your hands up if you've got a question, and somebody will come and bring a microphone over towards you. While we're waiting for... there's a question over there in the middle.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Kate. I'm from a bookshop on the peninsula. I'm curious about the comment that you made earlier about an educational role for children's books and that being either overdone or those sorts of things. If you could just elaborate on that a little bit.
Mm. Do you think children's books need to have a message or they need to be educational? You did touch on that. I think it'd be good to talk about that a bit more.
Well, I think if... I never set out to have a message, but I think if the book is written from the heart with, and you feed income about it, I think people, a message is there if you want to search for it, you know. But
you could find a message in a piece of art, painting,
yeah, of course,
that means something to you, but I don't think the painter sets out to create a message as such.
No.
Would you agree, Julie?
No.
Yeah, I think sometimes they do. And I mean, you know, you take a book... just comes to mind by Michael Foreman called Dinosaurs and All That Rubbish, and the whole point was it was a message about us not destroying our planet. And obviously, I think one of the great problems about picture books, or one of the most, or it's not a problem about them, but it shows their incredible versatility. A picture book has to work as this thing that a, you know, parent and a child shares in a little close triangle. It has to work as this thing that I sit here and I hold in front of 50 kids sitting on the carpet in front of me and they sort of all look at together. It has to work as what the kid may learn to read on, because that's the first thing that they look at again and again and again. So many different ways of absorbing that story. But where, what I don't like about... I mean, of course children's books are very much part of the education picture, and that's a very important thing. I think the difficulty is, and it's, you know, it gets to be true of English literature when we're taught it in secondary school, is when the books become, as it were, sort of texts to teach something. And I think... I wouldn't want people to write children's books with that in mind. I want people to write the book that they want to write, the story that matters to them, the thing that they're trying to say... and then see what happens when it's picked up.
And I think, I know Lee, I think Lee's editor's here. Publisher Erica, are you in here? Because we want to do a little call out for you. But I remember when I was working on a book with Erica at one stage, and her advice has always stayed with me, which is write what you care about. And I think if you do feel really strongly about an issue, it's going to come out in your writing, whether you set out to do it or not. It's
well,
just
I think
part of who you are.
Well, I think often the best ones are where it comes out subconsciously.
Yeah.
You know, because that forms how the direction and what you put in the book anyway. There's a bit of you in it. And
it's not didactic in that
beg
way.
Beg your pardon?
And then it doesn't become didactic.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Do we have another question?
I have to look that up. No, I'm joking. I know what it means.
You may not spell it.
Yeah.
Anyone else with a question? Great.
Oh, hi. I was listening earlier. I'm interested in the distinction that you made when you're reviewing a book between what the author's trying to achieve and the reaction of the child. As an interested mum, the reaction of my child to the book is something that guides me, or the reaction of other children, and she's a big fan of Billy B. Brown and Mr. Chicken. So I'm interested to hear more about that. Is that limited just to reviews, or...
of course, how children react to the book is very, very important. But particularly if you're reviewing the books as sort of part of, in The Guardian we do it as you know, as we would an adult book, as sort of part of how they're written, we do it from the other perspective, in a sense. That's to say, we're not looking at it saying, seven-year-olds will love this because it's a story about princesses. We're looking at how this particular story about a princess has been constructed. Obviously, there is no point in publishing a lot of literature which children aren't going to enjoy. That becomes self-defeating, in a sense. But I think authors also are creating readers and developing readers. And I would be worried if a children's writer felt constrained in what they wrote because they know a certain kind of book is popular. So I think we're always sort of looking at that mixture. I mean, obviously, I'm sorry to say Harry Potter again, but obviously after the publication of Harry Potter, we almost drowned in magical fantasy in the UK, partly because everybody was trying to find something else that was successful, but partly for, I think, much more interesting reason, which is that, and one of the wonderful things about being here is that this doesn't apply to being in Australia, but in the UK, children are watched every minute of every day. Children do nothing on their own at the moment. They don't go to school on their own. They don't play out on their own. They really have very little independence. And fantasy is a way of children exploring the world independently, in a sense. They can go with, you know, as the reader, they can go into the story and they can take on characters and opportunities that they won't find in real life. Because how else, if you've never walked to school on your own and had to be the person who, you know, crosses the road and looks after the cat that's been knocked over, or whatever it is, how would you know whether you would be brave, whether you would be true, whether you would be, you know, what kind of a response would you give to a situation? And Harry Potter, the kind of fantasy that we had after that, gave children that opportunity. So, in a sense, people were writing stories to please children, but they were also writing stories that fulfilled a very important emotional need for children. So the balance between whether it's childly popular or well written is its attention. They can marry, they can be all in one place, but it can be attention. And so, you know, I would take, we happen to have coincidentally in the UK Harry Potter and Philip Pullman. Now, you know, one is a literary phenomenon and one is in terms of the quality of Philip Pullman's writing, and the other is something that children have just taken to their hearts, and both have a very valid place, but they're different.
And often you see a difference between the books that find themselves on Children's Choice Award lists and ones that have been convened by adults.
And we need both.
I think so, yeah. Mm. Do you feel that, who are you writing for? Who do you create books for? Are you pleasing yourself first off, or are you thinking about your readership?
Yeah, well, I'm my, do you say best or worst critic? whatever. So I with Erica, I have an idea and then I set off. It's not being disingenuous to say I don't really know what the kids will get or what they won't. And that's, I think that distance for me is healthy. I never ever read my books to kids. I don't even like being in the room when they're looking at them. Truly, because there's something confronting, especially if they won't go beyond the front first time. I can't remember. What was the question?
Well, it was about who are you pleasing
when
you set out to create a book.
No. Yeah. It has to be me.
I think that's a really good response. I think anybody trying to, for anybody who's trying to write, I think if you're thinking too much about what will please the audience, you won't write the best book. I think you have to be thinking about the best book and about the audience, but it's that way around, not the other way around.
You have a sense of it anyway.
Yeah.
I love, in all the books that Erica and I've done together over 24 years now, there's never been once where Erica has said, no, you've stretched too far. Because our feeling is, let the kids stretch. Mm. I mean, in 4 F for Freaks, one of us came up with the word xylophone, and let's put it in. They'll look it up and they'll never forget it. And they'll drive their parents mad too by, you know, saying it. But that's the thing, you know, you stretch and don't patronise them. That's what I
don't patronise is absolutely essential at any stage. Mm. I mean, I think that's true throughout children's
reading. We often underestimate what children can do, yeah.
And just to pick up on that underestimation and your previous point about, is there anything that you can't do? I mean, I've have spent a lot of time defending books which parents have said were totally shocking and unsuitable mm-hmm. for their children. And, you know, I had great fun defending a book because I checked it out. It was for 11-year-olds, and I checked it out that it was actually far less explicit than anything that their kids have been learning in the PHSE curriculum. Right. You know, I think all parents think their children are phenomenally naive, and you feel like saying, just, let, you know, think what they're seeing all around them.
Yeah,
and
totally shocking would be a great band to put on the front of the book.
That would entice the kids in, wouldn't it? And surely a book is a safe place for children to explore difficult themes and emotions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Any more questions from the audience? We've got a few more minutes. Somebody in the middle there.
Hello. Oh, it's too loud, sorry. Like a lot of people, I grew up reading a lot of Roald Dahl books, which are wickedly cruel in their descriptions of characters and the things that happen to people. I was just wondering, in an age now where people are trying to be more progressive and inclusive, is there room for that kind of cruel humour, or do writers need to be more careful in how they portray things?
It's a great question. Mm. Who wants to tackle that one?
I don't think so. I don't think. Where do you stop? Mm-hmm. You know, it irritates me that Noddy gets fiddled with. You're not fiddled with.
Now, that's a good thing.
Sorry, Julia. I'll never be allowed in. No. What I mean is, you know, the Noddy books, you know, the illustrations by Beak, they've all been redone.
Yeah.
I think the thing with the Gollywogs, what they should do if they want is write a thing at the start and say, when this was done, there was a different attitude to certain things, and put it in a context. I don't like the idea of even of things. It's a form of censorship. But I think you know, to make people feel more comfortable and to that things can be put in context. Maybe.
What do you think, Julia?
The censorship one is really difficult. I mean, the one in the UK that's the most difficult probably is Dr. Doolittle, which was a big sort of classic. And, you know, there is a scene in which Prince Bumpo rubs his skin with pumice to try and make it white. You can't explain that to a child. Mm. And you can't have a kind of rider saying, you know, this wouldn't really happen. The point about Dahl and the grotesque and the cruel, I think, is... I've always had some unease about Dahl. I think overall about Dahl, I suppose what I feel is he redeems himself in my eyes by having some very strong, very positive characters. So, you know, you think of someone like Danny, the champion of the world, that loving relationship between the boy and his father is just, you know, I'd forgive Dahl a lot for that. I happen to think that The Twits is a particularly unpleasant story and does very little for anybody in my mind, but there you go. Some children think it's very, very funny. I don't think... It's how you handle difficult subjects, isn't it? I don't think you should shelter children from the fact that there is cruelty and ugliness in the world, but you have to resolve it well. And I suspect if one really unpicks Dahl, he does resolve it in a way that makes it kind of accessible or, you know, makes it bearable. I mean, there's a truism in children's book that the sort of one of the differences between writing for children and writing for adults is that you are meant to end with children going away feeling some sort of sense of hope and not despair. But, I mean, you know, I was brought up on stories like Harriet and the Matches, you know, those horrible, horrible straw beater stories. I mean, it was despair. She's dead. I mean, you know, you can't get much more despairing than that. So, but I think Dahl is a very, very interesting writer in how far he pushes those boundaries. And I think all writers need to be very sensitive to, you can be grotesque, you can be ugly, you can be cruel up to a certain point, but I think you have to resolve it in a way that makes the child feel it's possible to move on.
I wish we could keep going because I'm finding this so fascinating, but we have to wind up because we've run out of time. But as well as children's librarians, it's also really important to remember that children's booksellers are fantastic people putting books in the hands of children. When adults go to a bookstore, they have no idea what to buy. We will wind up this evening, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.